Hare Hare. It's Talent Night.
Alright, I'll go back to my seat now.
Amazing, beautiful. Wow.
I wasn't born with physical powers in this machine.
That was old-timey religion right there, let me tell you.
This machine was not born with the ability to do good music.
That's kirtan the way we used to do kirtan back in the 60s.
Oh, I've heard stories about you guys being...
Really?
Very odd human.
And we would go on for hours and hours and hours. Amazing. Really amazing. Well, welcome all of you. Don't crowd. There's room for everybody. Those of you in podcast land, that was a joke. There's four people here tonight. You know what I thought we would do for a change? First of all, snuggle up, you know, people. Because, like, you know, with only four of us, there's no reason to be strangers. Come on down.
Hey, Rob.
And leave the door open, because you never know. You know what I thought we might do is get back to a little bit more systematic study of this fourth chapter, because I'd like us to move on to the fifth chapter eventually. So here's what we're going to do. Take your copy of Gita Wisdom and open, if you would please, to page 20. And we're going to take turns reading the verses. We're going to go through all of chapter 4. We're going to get a little bit of a vinyasa flow to what chapter 4 is all about. Okay? So here's the background, and this will be very good because you're going to get tested on this. Chapter 1 of the Bhagavad Gita. Who can tell me what the subject of chapter 1 is of the Bhagavad Gita? All right, I'll tell you. Chapter 1 is called Setting the Scene. It's essentially a summary of the action about to take place in this epic battle. You have the setup of the blind king Dhritarashtra, whose malicious sons are on the opposite side of the battlefield from Arjuna and his brothers, the righteous Pandava princes. And this blind king asks his secretary, Sanjaya, to channel the vision of what's happening on the battlefield. And what Sanjaya tells him is initially there's this extraordinary sounding of drums and blowing of conch shells and trumpets, and it's a battle about to take place. And then he goes through some of the discussion that's happening among the generals and the heads of the armies. Dhritarashtra's eldest son, Duryodhana, for example, is telling grandfather Bhishma, whom everyone knows has a soft spot for the Pandavas, "Are you sure you're going to fight with full vigor for us once we're out there on the battlefield?" Because he knows there's a chance that Bhishma will soften seeing his beloved Pandava princes on the other side. So that's basically chapter 1. And what happens in chapter 1 is Arjuna, who's ready to fight, all of a sudden gets cold feet. He says, "Krishna, before we start this battle, please pull my chariot up between the two armies and let me see who's arrayed here to fight." Krishna does that, and Sanjaya describes that Arjuna sees the elders of the family. He sees his beloved grandfather Bhishma there. He sees cousins. He sees people whom he has grown up with. And as envious as they may have been, these are still family, and they're the leaders of society. So chapter 1 is really setting the scene of the Gita. At the end of the first chapter, Arjuna admits his inability to fight. And he lays down his bow and arrows and sits down on the chariot. Now, this is a very unheroic thing for a Kshatriya warrior to do. Does anyone know the meaning of the word Kshatriya?
Warrior caste.
It's the warrior caste. The word itself is comprised of two parts, Chat and Traya. Chat means harm, and Traya means liberation or freedom. For example, the word mantra is comprised of two parts, Manas Traya, freedom from the mind. By chanting your mantra each day, you properly manage the fluctuations of the mind. The Kshatriya is one who liberates citizens from harm. So that's the first rule of government. Actually, I'm appreciative that there are even four of you here tonight, given that it's the second presidential debate.
Couldn't watch it.
And it's at Hofstra.
And it's at Hofstra, where I could not get in, despite seniority. And it's also the crucial third game of the American League Championship Series, where the Yankees will either pull it out of a tailspin or they won't.
This is far more important.
So here we are with Krishna and Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Very interesting. You get extra points. More prasadam for us. That's right.
What do we have for dinner tomorrow?
We have pumpkin.
We have pumpkin cake. We have vegan pumpkin cake with yummy, non-oily icing. I don't know how she did it, but Kim came up with this really lovely thing. And strawberries.
Yeah.
So we feast tonight.
I love Kim's cooking.
Yeah. Kim is with her family tonight. I think her son had a soccer match or something like that. All right. That's chapter one. Chapter two, Bhagavad Gita, is... Yes, Kim.
Share.
Share.
Is that the one where Krishna has a discussion with him and tries to reassure him that he is not his body?
Yes, exactly. Very good. Chapter two is all about the difference between the body and the soul. It's the foundational teaching of the Gita. Essentially, he's talking Arjuna down from his hysteria. He's saying, okay, calm down. Let's talk about this. Are we our bodies? No. What are we? We're eternal soul. So it's a starting point. And if you're ever in a situation where someone is hysterical, you're going to want to talk them down by bringing them back to some basics. Don't get into deep philosophy with them right away. You're just going to freak them out. So the Gita goes through a progressive deepening of the philosophy. But in chapter two, it's basic stuff. If you don't get this right, you can't understand anything else. If you don't know that you're not your body, none of the other teachings of the Gita are going to make any sense at all. So that's chapter two. Chapter three starts off with Arjuna essentially challenging Krishna because he's not convinced yet. He's still in that kind of very anxious condition. And what's the first thing you do if you're confronted with something that you know you have to do, but you don't want to do it?
You want to run away.
And then what's the next thing you do? If someone says, why aren't you doing what you're supposed to be doing?
You make excuses.
You say, well, you know, I've thought about this and I don't think it's the right thing to do.
I don't want to kill my
I shouldn't kill those people. The scriptures tell me I shouldn't do this. It'll wreak havoc in society. What happens if all these men die? That means there'll be wives and widows and little babies without fathers. And it goes through all these very sophisticated arguments. Krishna's response to him is kutas. Kutas in Sanskrit means, where is all of this language coming from? Where from? Where is it coming from? All of this stuff. He says, you're speaking like a non-Aryan, like someone who does not know the higher value of human life. So in this third chapter, Krishna describes for Arjuna karma, action devoid of selfish interest. He talks about how the person of knowledge enters into an unpleasant situation knowing that it has to be done, so he or she begins from a place of asking how this will benefit others. Can this be done in such a way that it adds to the general well-being? Now, Arjuna at first was thinking this is not going to add to the general. So what Krishna tells him is, no, there's a higher duty here. See yourself as the vehicle of some higher purpose and you won't be so nervous about yourself. Who lives happily in this world? Those who serve others. You know, it's an amazing thing, but if you're really anxious about your own situation, if you calm down and remember that Krishna is in your heart, and he's got your back, he's looking out for you, then what does that do? That frees you up to actually be thinking, okay, what's the deeper story going on here? Remember the two basic lessons of Bhagavad Gita? What are the two lessons?
I was going to say that doesn't he also in the third chapter talk about when you're in a battle, when you're in a war, it's the last resort. But if you've done everything, he's trying to reassure him in that you have done everything you can and negotiated every way you possibly can. Mm-hmm. And this is the only way to really resolve it.
Well, there is some hint of that in the third chapter. We learn that in greater detail in the Mahabharata, where we get the story, the backstory of how the Pandavas and Krishna tried every imaginable way to avoid conflict, armed conflict. Everything possible was done to avoid having to fight and kill. Yeah.
The Gita is about doing your dharma with integrity, right action, and serving ultimately Krishna. Or the divine, or God, since we're a podcast land.
All right, now, well, that's very good. I'm glad you mentioned that. So that's the perfect bridge into the fourth chapter, because it's right there that we start getting into trouble. I've been teaching Bhagavad Gita now for 20-some-odd years, and some of the years have truly been odd. And what I find is that everything is good up until the point where you got to get into this whole notion of Krishna is a real person. And the message of the Gita is to give yourself over to this person, Krishna. It's at that point that things start to sound religious, and that raises all kinds of distasteful associations. So what happens in this fourth chapter, from the very beginning, is that Krishna states his credentials. He's basically trying to reassure Arjuna, and through Arjuna, everybody else, that it's okay. I'm not the god of religion. I'm not that person whom you have always been fearful of, because it's been about thou shalt and thou shalt not, and if you do this, this bad thing's going to happen to you. That's not who I am. So who is he? Well, let's get into the fourth chapter. We're going to go around the room. Ron, would you please read on page 20 the first verses, 1 through 3. Reading glasses. That helps. Very good. All right. Fourth chapter, verses 1 through 3 on page 20. Krishna said...
Krishna describes the Gita.
No, not the introductory section. Just go right to the verses.
Verses 4.1 in the first paragraph.
Oh, Krishna said, what I teach you is not me. At the dawn of creation, I taught the science of the self, the sun god, and it was passed down in a
parampara succession.
Succession of teachings. What is parampara?
Parampara, we'll get to that. Just finish the verses and then we'll start unpacking it all.
The teachers were lost. I make you the new keeper of this wisdom because you are my friend and can understand its mystery.
Okay, this is a hi Rodney. This is a critical section of the Bhagavad Gita, because here we learn the history of the Gita, not as some historic text that had its moment of origin in material time, but as an eternal teaching that was passed down starting at the very dawn of creation. The example that I like to use is of an instruction booklet. When you buy a new piece of software and you install it in your computer, you get an instruction booklet that comes along that explains how to use it, or some new piece of technology. so that you'll use it properly and it won't, you know, mess up on you. Revealed texts are a little bit like instruction booklets that come with the creation. How to live in this world without becoming unnecessarily entangled in the karmic ball of wax. So he's describing that this science was first taught by me to the sun god and passed down in parampara succession, but that over time the teachings were lost. Now, why do you think... He doesn't explain why they were lost. There isn't room enough or time enough in this discussion just prior to battle. What does your instinct tell you why wisdom teachings would be lost? What's a good guess? Huh?
It's the decline of Dharma.
Or the decline of Dharma. Mm-hmm. Yes, that as the interest in leading a religious life, a holy life, dwindles, the teachings can be lost just because there's lack of interest. And then so that's one reason.
The last great avatar was Ram. That was like 10,000 years, 100,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. According to, you know, from the time of Krishna, Ram, and Ram is Krishna. Mm-hmm. So, and during that period, one of Ram's thing was to wipe out the Kshatriya class.
Well, you're getting a little tricky there. Let's stick with the first comment, which was a good one. Namely, that there's teachings can be lost through to attrition. It's a lack of interest. What's another reason why teachings may be lost?
I was just saying, maybe lost is another word for forgotten, because you get distracted by the material world and you forget who you really are.
Yeah. Lost not in the sense that they're being hidden, but lost in the sense that through neglect, they dissipate and they're not being protected anymore. Ron, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I was going to say that too, but people...
I think what you said when people change, where I thought you were going was people change the teachings, and that's another reason that they're lost.
They change or they're led by force.
Yeah. You, like anything in this world, you can abuse and misuse wisdom. There was Charles Manson back in the 60s. I don't know if you remember Manson. It was a crazy person who's still in prison. He essentially brainwashed his followers to kill a group of nursing students. And when he was captured and asked, "Why did you do that? Why did you compel these people to kill? And, you know, what was your motive?" He said, "Well, I've been reading the Bhagavad Gita. And in the Bhagavad Gita, it says that even killing, you do not kill because the soul never dies." So you can justify anything with reference to scripture. So by abusing the wisdom, it can be lost. Lack of interest, it can be lost. So for any number of reasons. So he says, "I make you the new keeper of wisdom." Why? Why is Arjuna chosen as the new link in the disciplic chain? What are his qualifications? What does Krishna say here?
Well, he's his friend.
Yes, you are my friend and can understand its mysteries. It's surprising how many times Krishna says that. That I'm giving this to you because I trust you, I love you. Because you love me. If you have a secret, if you have some sensitive information about yourself, are you going to give that to just anybody? Why not? What happens if you reveal something sensitive about yourself to somebody else? What could happen?
They can betray you.
They can betray. They can use it against you. It's a privilege to be taken into someone's confidence. And that's a privilege that you don't want to abuse or dishonor. So Krishna is saying, "I trust you, Arjuna. We've known each other throughout all our lives. And I know that you're not envious of me. That you're not going to use my position as the Godhead against me. Essentially, right? Now, this is going to sound silly, maybe, but put yourself in Krishna's position for a moment, if you would. Right? You're the supreme being. All creation flows from you. What is it that is most frequently... What is the most frequent occurrence? What is it you have to put up with more than anything else? I mean, people using your name in vain, claiming to be you, you know, doing all kinds of abominable things and saying that you're the one who told them to do it. You know, God made me do it. Okay? So here's Krishna telling Arjuna, I know you're not going to do that to me. You're not going to use this against me. So I'm going to share this with you. Okay? So this fourth chapter is extraordinary. Cher, would you pick up on page 21, please, and read the verses 4:4 through 4:15.
Arjuna said, your birth came later. How is it possible that you taught this to the Sangha? Krishna said, you and I are both eternal, Arjuna. Because my body is not different from me, I remember the past, but you do not. In each millennium, when Dharma is in decline, I appear in this world to protect the sadhus, subdue evildoers, and reestablish the pattern of righteousness. Those who understand this truth about my appearance and activities never return to the world of birth and death.
Chakva deham punarjanmaneti mamiti sarjuna. Important verses here in this fourth chapter. So here again, Arjuna is what? He's challenging Krishna. He's still not convinced. He's still not convinced. He's saying, wait a minute now. How am I supposed to understand this? You and I grew up together, and here you're saying that you taught the sun god at the dawn of creation? Because why? If he can discredit Krishna, then he won't have to do what?
He won't have to fight.
He won't have to follow his advice. Nah, you're just tricking me. So Arjuna is challenging him again. It's not a competitive frame of mind, but it's a fearful frame of mind. Why do you challenge? Why do we talk back?
Because you don't want to do what somebody's telling you to do.
You're afraid. You know, you're afraid. When people become argumentative, it's not necessarily because they're trying to win a point. It's because they're afraid of what's the subject under discussion.
Or they're afraid of being controlled by the other person.
Yeah.
In this case, Krishna is reassuring him that he's his friend and he's someone who can be trusted.
Yes.
And he's also reassuring him and letting him know that he not only is he his friend, but Krishna recognizes him as a being that's evolved enough to handle this. Mm-hmm.
But Arjuna doesn't really have the self-confidence to take up that responsibility yet, so he's raising all of these objections. There's a new production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I think it may still be in previews, I'm not sure. That's an extraordinary, extraordinary piece of theater where something somewhat similar happens. You have George and Martha at each other's throats. I mean, psychically ripping each other to shreds. They're so cruel. And what's extraordinary about it is that the audience can't help but think these two people are going to kill each other. And what is it that you're actually seeing happening on stage? You're seeing two people who could not love each other more, but are terrified of their own shortcomings. And so they're reacting in this extraordinarily hurtful way, coming out with all this language, you know. You couldn't this and you couldn't that and you never. And, you know, and at one point, as the evening progresses, Martha finally confesses to the young professor and his wife, who were their guests, that I don't even deserve him, because he said this will do. He said, I will fulfill him. And he made me the love of his life. I'm paraphrasing here. But we react sometimes with very strong language because we're afraid of the truth of what's being discussed here. So that's happening here. So Krishna, once again, like a very good therapist, is telling Arjuna, it's okay. We're both eternal. You and I are eternal. But I remember the past. You don't remember them. Why not? What is the explanation that Krishna gives here? Why is it that Krishna is able to remember all of these experiences from millions of years ago and Arjuna is not able to?
He doesn't have to experience the process of birth and death.
That's correct. Krishna and his body are not different. This is the mystery of Krishna, and it comes up again several times later in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, people think avajananti mamuta manusim tanamashritam parambhava ajananto mamabhuta maheshwaram. He says, people think that I've taken a material body in order to come into this world and to interact with human society. They don't understand that this is me. This is my higher nature. Krishna and his body are not different. They are pure spirit. We come into the world and we take on material bodies because we are, first of all, we're not fully liberated souls. We have an eternal spiritual body, but it is not manifest now. What's manifest is the shape of our own thoughts in the form of a physical body. This physical body is the external, gross material manifestation of your thoughts, desires, dreams, wishes, words, actions from previous lives. All of that psychic preset, those directions that you wish to take, literally take shape, and that's also reflected in the creation. The way the material world comes out at the dawn of, you know, what science might call the Big Bang, or more technically, zero plus one, that moment when there was a point of actualizing creation. The unrolling of elements happens from subtle to gross, from ethereal to tangible, physical. So the first element was sound. The first element of creation was sound. As the Bible says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So that primal creative sound in the Sanskrit text is what? It's Om. That Om is called the Pranav Omkara, the breath of life that came and animated the universe. So with sound came the medium for transporting sound, namely space. Without an environment for sound to transmit, there's no place for that sound to go. And along with that creation of sound and space came the tool of perception of hearing. And then it's described that sound gradually transformed into air, and then air into fire, and fire into water, and water into earth. And along with each of those elements came the concomitant or respective sensory perception. So hearing, and then the sense of smell and touch and taste and so on. So all of the senses emerged along with those elements, and the creation went from subtle to gross. So too with this body, if you will, this is a kind of microcosmic creation, which is the manifestation, the physical manifestation of the subtle condition of our previous lives. Are there any questions about that? It's a bit complex, and the descriptions in the Puranas or the histories, is quite detailed. But the point is that Krishna's body does not go through that creative process. When we, the minute soul, take birth, in the womb of the mother, those material elements aggregate. The soul acts like a magnet, and the material elements aggregate around that soul and begin to grow because the life force is present. If a child is stillborn, there's no further growth. There's no more aggregation of those elements. The body does not develop. So when a child is born, what you have is the soul wrapped in these various layers of material elements, both gross and subtle. The subtle elements are mind, intelligence, and ego. Those are the invisible elements that comprise the physical, material shell, the gross and subtle physical shells that are the vehicle of the soul in this lifetime. Krishna does not go through any of that. His body never develops in that way. It's eternal. When he was present on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, he was about 125 years old. By the calculation of the story, he looked like a young man in his 20s. He never ages. You never hear stories of Krishna as an old man. His body never ages beyond youth, beyond young adulthood. Right, so here he's describing for Arjuna, you don't remember because you've been changing bodies all this time. I don't. It's the same me who was there at the dawn of time. So I recall all of these experiences. And anyone who understands this about me never comes back to this world. Now, why would that be? Why is it that just understanding Krishna would be the key to moksha, the key to liberation?
Could you go to where you want to go?
Okay. All right, that was a challenging answer. I have to think about that one.
Sorry.
To know Krishna in truth means to know yourself in truth. Just as the example is given that when the sun rises in the morning, you can see yourself. In darkness, you can't see yourself. But when the sun rises, you can see yourself. So when you know Krishna in truth, it means that you know yourself in truth. And at that point, there's this whole other perspective on how to act in the world and how to be in the world. Oh my gosh, I'm not the sum total of all my life's traumas. I'm an eternal soul. I have all of these other resources that I never knew, I never realized. So that, therefore, Krishna says, one who knows me. Now, he doesn't say they never return immediately. This could take lifetimes. But that's the key. That's the trigger point. Is knowing the truth about Krishna's identity. And at that point, you're on the path. You're on the bhakti path. And there's no turning back. You know, one of the things that my god brothers and god sisters in Krishna consciousness are always telling me is that they could never go back to the material life. And I know a lot of them who have tried. But frankly, once you've had a taste of this life of devotion, your material life is finished. you can't go back to it. You can try to go back to it. You know, you might go back to it for a while, but you know better. You know better. Once you understand that you're an eternal soul, there's no going back. You know?
There's like no desire for any material thing.
No, the desire may still be there, but the satisfaction isn't there anymore.
It's boring.
It gets boring. Because you've had a glimpse of what life could be in that realm of devotion to Krishna. The sense that, oh my God, this place where I get to see divinity in all beings. And instead of the frustration of sexual tension and power plays and financial maneuverings, there's this other place for us to be together. That, you know, chanting and dancing and prasadam, and, You know, really bad jokes at Sunset Kita. You know, that's, it's this other place you can go to. And once you've had that, you know, once you've had the best, you leave the rest. Yeah, it really is. It's a giddy sensation. All right, you're up. You're going to read starting at the verse 10 through 15 there at the bottom of 21, if you will.
However people understand me, and however they offer themselves to me, I return their dedication in kind. Most worship God for some end, according to their station in life. Those stations, called Varnas, were created by me. I am unchangeable and not subject to material designations, nor is there any work that I am obligated to perform. In the past, many great souls have known this truth concerning my nature, and they acted with this understanding. Perform your duty, following their example.
Okay. Yeya tamam prapadyante tamstateva bhajami aham. That's the Sanskrit of that first verse there. Everyone follows my path in all respects. Now, this is why we have to study Gita together, because no one knows what that means otherwise. Everyone, when Krishna says, everyone follows my path in all respects, he doesn't mean it's all good. You know, that whatever you want to do, it's my path. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, and this is the next line, the next verse. People do the best they can. It's not always great, but they do the best they can. And as they perceive me, and as they enter into a relationship with me, I reciprocate with them as far as they will allow me. Someone who is an outright, you know, born-again atheist, dyed-in-the-wool, a religious atheist, you know, just insists on the non-existence of God.
A fanatical atheist.
A, you know, dyed-in-the-wool believing atheist. Like my dad, for example.
I was
going to
say,
you know, yeah, right,
what about Brian?
How does Krishna appear to such people? What form are they obliged to acknowledge? What experience in life that is a divine experience in its final state?
Death.
Yes. For those people who, for whom the notion of divinity is just completely cut off. And that's, you know, usually not through any kind of really rational explanation or you know, sound arguments. It's anger, usually. Scratch an atheist and you'll find someone really angry at the church. You know, who has this image of God as this really nasty person who's represented by a bunch of nasty priests.
Or they're angry because of the mystery of
God. Or they're angry because they can't make any sense of this. They can't make heads or tails out of how the world operates.
Why
do bad things happen to good people? If there's a God, and God is, you know, good enough for us to want to love God, what? Hey? You know? What's this world all about then? You know, why would God even tolerate this going on for 1 second, for 1 minute? So that's the response to an aberration. That's not divinity. That's the manipulative, top-down, dogmatic, church-bound, and I say the word church in its metaphorical sense.
I think that's the biggest challenge with your people's relationship with God.
Why absolutely.
Bad things happen to good yeah. people. Why do light devour?
That is the single hardest thing of all. Right. And it comes up most prominently in the 11th chapter of the Gita when Krishna reveals his universal form. And he says, okay, here I am, warts and all. Here I am.
Yeah, he's everything.
Take it, yeah. And all of the bad stuff comes out. Arjuna looks at it and says, I cannot even bear to look at this.
He's like, I'm a demon, I'm a shark,
I'm everything.
Shiva.
All these things.
I mean, yeah. He goes on.
Goes on and on.
Wow, you're bad.
So here we have Krishna saying, if that's the only way that I can reciprocate with people as death, I'll do. I don't prefer that. Krishna doesn't prefer that. But that will become the way they reciprocate. I know someone who is on his deathbed right now. I might have mentioned this to you last time. It's inoperable cancer, and he's probably at best days or a week away from death. And this is not someone who is ever particularly religious. At the recent holiday services, he was the only one who asked for the prayers to be said at the dinner. Nobody was feeling in particular like, you know, doing the ritual. He asked. Because there's something about coming close to death. All of a sudden, the idea of something else than just a black hole starts to become a little appealing. So Krishna appears in different ways according to people's capacity to see him. Yes, Rodney.
About death. When I was dying, you know, everything was going, and I said some prayers and that. But I was still going. And it seemed like no chance.
Mm.
So I forget about the prayers. I already said it. So I said, you know what was left.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, don't give up on yourself, which is my favorite 6 words. But I'm still going, quicker and quicker, there's no way out.
Mm.
And then, no prayers, I just said, I'm not dead yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like so rejuvenating that like all my strength was depleted, mm-hmm. nothing, breath, everything's going. And just from that, like, that line I said is like, gave me hope to live.
Don't give up on yourself, that line?
That didn't finish. No.
Uh-huh.
I was trying that,
mm-hmm.
and I was like getting weaker and weaker, going every moment. I got out of the ambulance. Mm-hmm. And I said, there was nothing left for me to say so that I could think of, and I said, I'm not dead yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it just like rejuvenated.
Mm-hmm. Even that little bit, absolutely, that little bit of saying, I'm not dead yet, is an acknowledgement of sorts that something else is going on. I'm not dead yet. Something else is still happening here. So there's an acknowledgement there. And, you know, it's extraordinary. Sometimes it's said, this is the tradition, that if you take one small step toward Krishna, he'll take 100 steps toward you. He's just looking for an opening. He's just looking for anything at all. The smallest little, you know, come on over, and he's there. Anything at all. Just like, well, I'm not dead yet. That's enough. Okay, then I'm here for you as life. Thank you for letting me in. That's a beautiful thing. So it goes on in the fourth chapter. Krishna says, I'll explain the meaning of karma, which challenges even brilliant minds. There is inaction, improper action, and proper action. Inaction, like improper action, carries karmic consequences. To avoid karmic reaction, act without personal motive. As soon as you take the responsibility for something, you also take on the karmic reaction for what you're doing. As soon as it's for you, just be prepared. Because whatever you do, the reaction is on your shoulders. If you're not doing it for you, where's the reaction going to go? It's absorbed in transcendence. And if you're acting in devotion, not only is there no reaction, you're making spiritual progress. There's a positive spiritual benefit to everything that you do. So it's the exact opposite of what happens when someone acts from selfish motive. So here is Krishna describing for Arjuna how to avoid karmic reaction. There is no consequence to selfless work, he says, which is work conducted without coveting its results. That's awfully hard. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I have a tough time with this one. Because I'm always working to get the results. You know, everything I do, I want to get results from it. Yeah. So how do we do this? How do we work? First of all, what does it mean? What is it, you know, the verse says, There is no consequence to selfless work, which is work conducted without coveting its results. And let me read the rest. Those who are content with little, who envy no one, and are unshaken by either success or failure, such souls are already free of all karmic consequences. What is it that allows you to do that? What allows you, as the Native Americans say, to walk through the world casting no shadow and leaving no footprint?
Harmony with nature would be Native American.
Huh?
If you don't mind Native American, it would be harmony with nature.
Okay, and harmony with nature, that's certainly part of it. If you're not acting contrary to the laws of nature, that is to say, that this is in the third chapter, this harmonious relationship that was established at the dawn of creation. This is in the beginning of third chapter. At the dawn of time, the Supreme Being, here's Krishna talking about himself in the third person, the Supreme Being sent forth generations of humans and different species of life and the natural world, along with yajna, Y-A-J-N-A, yajna, which means what? Do we know what the word yajna means? Sacrifice. Sacrifice, meaning to make sacred, with prescriptions for making everything you do an act of making sacred. And saying, be happy by respecting this relationship that you have with nature. Because if you do, it will bestow upon you everything you need. That's an extraordinary thing, yeah.
I'll tell you something. No, the story of life is like you got to know what you have to do. That's the main thing in life. Have to know by now, whenever, what you got to do, and that is the whole answer. You practice yoga, and that will tell you exactly everything. You don't know the self yet. When you know what you're doing with your goal, when you reach that, then you'll know everything in this book. You'll know who you are. The beginning, I said, is you got to know what you have to do. Once you know that, that's like you laid all the groundwork, you start.
Exactly. Exactly. It starts by knowing the basics. It starts by knowing the basics, and then eventually you reach a point where it becomes spontaneous, and everything that you do is an act of devotion. So the basics mean to understand what's the system that we're in. What's the world that we're in here? Right? When you go someplace, you learn the rules so that you don't get yourself into trouble. You know, if you're driving and you're from England and you're driving on the left side of the street, ignorance of the law is no excuse. You're going to get a ticket.
So ignorance of karma, you're going to still get the karma.
That's right. Even though you may not know, these are the rules of the relationship with nature. There is a consequence to your action. Right? Perhaps the people at Monsanto have never read the Bhagavad Gita. You know? But what they do to the environment carries a consequence. Ignorance is no excuse. Well, that's an interesting observation. There is an intuition. I agree with that. I would say that there is some intuition, some part of us, our better self, that actually knows. When you're doing something wrong, you know it. You know, you don't need anybody to tell you. You know, I shouldn't be doing this. You know it. There is that inner sense of wisdom. That's super soul in the heart.
So you're saying to avoid karma, either do it for the sake of others, by either working and providing a certain amount of monetary wealth gain as charity, or to pass it and for when somebody says, oh, wow, you're so great at this.
All right, well, here's what's interesting. I had a conversation with a very dear friend of mine earlier today who's a very successful businessman and a very sincere devotee. And he was confiding in me that he's having a really hard time because he's always asking himself, how much is too much? Here's someone who's made millions of dollars in his business, and with that money he's built temples in India, he's supported all kinds of environmental initiatives, he's doing all kinds of good work, really, really good work. But what he's got to do in business and how much of himself, you know, the stress and the anxiety and the tension that this guy lives with is absolutely incredible. And he's always living with this sense of, you know, like, when do I give it up? You know, what do I do? And I've had that conversation with several people in the past few weeks. People want to know, like, I don't know how much more of this I can take. I have to work so hard. Now, what they do may be very successful, but that stress of working very hard is deadly. It's a toxic condition that can really bring you down. So when Krishna talks about, you know, acting without coveting the results, without being shaken by success or failure, he's not saying don't give it your all, don't give your work your best effort. Not at all. Not at all. Whatever you undertake, you have to undertake it with enthusiasm and stick it out to the end. This is described later in the Gita as working in goodness. When you work straight through to the end, no matter how hard it gets, that's work in goodness. Work in passion is work that is undertaken without considering what the consequences are, and often in the course of that work you're hurting others. And work undertaken in the mode of ignorance is work that's hurtful, and that you give up before you achieve it. Oh, I can't do it. Work in goodness is work that's carried through to completion for the right purpose. So you have to do what you have to do to the best of your ability. But what Krishna says here in this fourth chapter is, let go of obsessing over the results of what you're doing. Let that work reflect your character and who you are. That people will see. You know, in Hollywood, best example, right? Hollywood. You could be a filmmaker whose every film has lost money. This is for real. But if you've delivered your film on time and on budget, you will stay working. Now, really, check this out. There are directors I know whose films have never turned a profit, but they are always working. Why? Because the ability to complete a film on time and on budget is golden. Studios will fall all over themselves to have somebody who's dependable like that. Because what are they acquainted with? These divas, you know, who say, oh, I'm going to make this film for $50 million, and it becomes $100 million, you know, and they're never going to recoup. They'll never go into overages, you know. What is it that employers look for these days? Is it people with fancy degrees? Work ethic. It's people they can trust. It's people you can trust. So that's what's being inculcated here. Okay. Given the overwhelming attendance at tonight's class,
we have
you don't see all of the invisible people who are in attendance here, all the demigods and the great souls who are also with us. And on the altar we have Prabhupada, and is Radhanath Swami up there?
Yes.
Radhanath Swami and
Chaitanya.
Panchatattva, Chaitanya and his associates, Radha and Krishna. We got a full house.
And all the deities on the wall.
All the deities, everyone is here.
And all the great sages up here.
And all of our friends in podcast land. Who knows how many of those?
Including the person from South Africa and the one person from Japan and Switzerland.
We have South Africa, Japan, and Switzerland in attendance this evening?
Most likely the Jiva Mukti.
Wonderful.
Well, that's a few. Still
are there good ones, right?
Are we done, you said?
I'm saying, let's have our Artik and our vegan treats. What do you think?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. So
it's Kim's banana pumpkin bread.
So thank you all for coming.
We doing our RT first?
We're gonna do our RT now.
Cheers up, right?
Thank you.
So well.